Star, so good morning in this unusual place. It's a nice place though. So last time we really, I showed you this RG Triumph, and so that this 4 minus D, when you treat it as a small parameter expansion, is very, very successful. And so you calculate it in your tutorial, the critical exponents, and so here is the full table of them, and you can always, you know, compare the mean field theory value is this RG epsilon expansion. And so we have done only, you know, we have taken only, well, we went to the second order, basically. So you can do better in high orders, but this is just the second order. And this is the numerical value. So now you see that really, you know, the RG is better thing than the mean field theory. Especially impressive is this beta. So the mean field theory predicts 1/2. RG, you know, in our approximation gives you 0.33, and the true value is 0.326. So I think that's pretty impressive. And you see that basically, you know, in every column here, you get, you know, something better than the mean field theory. Of course, if you try to expand this to two-dimensional Ising model, it wouldn't be so impressive. Yes?
I'm slightly confused because the errors of some values are very small and some are a lot larger.
Yeah.
But like once you have two of them, you have all.
That's right. Yeah. So you can check that you know, all these predictions, well, they satisfy the scaling laws, and so yeah, it's true that here only two critical exponents are independent. So basically, you know, we could have stopped by saying, well, we calculated eta, so our approximation was equal to zero, and we calculated nu here, and then everything else follows. But yeah, you can do it, you know, from basic principles, and you can calculate all these critical exponents. But you're right, only two of them are independent.
What I mean is, if I have a linear equation involving two parameters, and one of them I know to a very high accuracy.
But they are not linear. The scaling laws are not linear always. So you have, for example, delta times beta or something. So some of them actually are a little bit more complicated. So yeah, they are not all of them are not linear, if you look at the scaling laws. Okay, so I think this is really a triumph of RG and this 4 minus the expansion. So now let me just conclude. Some conclusion. And so basically, we have seen that RG allows for analytic calculations. Let's take computation of critical exponents of course this was still an expansion, so we still did an expansion in small epsilon, and people are trying to get the exact values all the time, so yeah, there are various much more complicated techniques to get the exact values of these critical exponents, but yeah, this is a certainly an improvement.
You can put the hockey stick
like this. You mean on that?
Yeah.
It'll just fall. I'll just hold it. That's
no,
okay.
But the with that.
Yeah, I'll just hold it. That's okay. It also, you know, explains this universality. Of continuous phase transitions.
How so?
So basically what we started this was this Ising universality class, and we started this Landau-Ginzburg function corresponding to Z2 symmetry and corresponding to one order parameter. And you know, for all these classes which have the same Landau-Ginzburg function, you predict the same critical exponents.
Yeah, you say that it allows for an analytic computation, but we did make like a lot of approximations.
Sure.
Anyway, right?
Yeah, analytic approximative calculations.
what exactly?
But there's no analytic calculations in physics, right? Everything is an approximation in some sense.
I mean, given a model, not anymore.
And
so what exactly do you mean by an analytic computation?
Well, you can actually calculate something analytically, right? You don't need to do heavy numerics like Monte Carlo simulations or stuff
I
like that.
I can do it by hand.
Yeah. It also provides foundations foundations, how to model for how we model condensed matter systems. I don't know almost anything about that, but you will have the whole course on condensed matter, and maybe you'll see what's going on there. So basically, you know, we can start as a very complicated microscopic Hamiltonian describing all the interactions of electrons and ions in your condensed matter system. But so you have lots of interacting terms. But basically, if you subject this microscopic Hamiltonian to this RG procedure, so you are interested in, you know, large-scale physics, then you are zooming out of the system. And so basically, it turns out that many of these interacting terms will be irrelevant for your microscopic physics. And so we can basically, you know, destroy them, and then your problem simplifies drastically. So in the end, you end up with something which is almost non-interacting thing, and you can actually calculate something. And so this, for example, you know, justifies why an approximation of non-interacting electrons in the crystal is a good approximation. But you will learn much more about this in your condensed matter class. But that really, you know, I can do if I am interested in large-scale physics here, then I can do drastic simplifications of the problem, and I don't have to consider 10 to 23 interacting things. Okay, so that's the conclusion. So basically, these three very important conclusions. So of course, so far, we concentrated. On Ising universality class. That means that we had this Z2 symmetry, discrete symmetry, and we had one order parameter phi. It's just one order parameter, scale order parameter, if you want. And so for that we constructed what the Landau-Ginzburg functional is, and then we did the RG flow and calculated everything we wanted to calculate. So now what I would like to do today is that I would like to start doing other systems which don't have this Z2 symmetry, but which have continuous symmetry. And you'll see that new features actually emerge in those systems. So part E will be systems with continuous symmetry. And so, as a prototype of a system with continuous symmetry is the vector model. So, it's something which is called vector model. Again, it will be a model of ferromagnetism. Again, you will have some, you know, lattice, and the spins will live on that lattice. But now you don't describe your spins as, you know, pointing up or down, so plus or minus, but you describe them as vectors. So at each lattice point, you have a n-dimensional vector which describes your spin. So spins are now n vectors. So you have at lattice side I have the corresponding vector, which will be S1i, S2i, up to n, Sni. And so then you prescribe your Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian will be basically exactly the same as we had for the Ising one, so it's just minus 1/2, and then sum over I and J, Jij, Si vector dot Sj vector. So that's your Hamiltonian. And you see that, you know, it looks very similar to the dizing model, but now we have more complicated description of our spins. Okay, and of course you require that these spins, let's say, are normalized, so you can put that, you know, at each side, you know, the spin has is normalized to one. Okay. So by the way, if you take n equal to three, and this has a special name, and it's actually a model proposed by a Heisenberg. So n equal to three is Heisenberg model. So how low can you see? Can you see this? Is that okay? Or okay? No. So now if you look at this Hamiltonian, so there's a scalar product of two vectors here. So the original Ising Hamiltonian had this Z2 symmetry. But now I have a symmetry which actually leaves my scalar product intact. Of course, something that leaves a scalar product intact is a rotation. So you can rotate all the spins if you rotate them no matter how. But if you rotate them all of them equally, then this thing does not change. Okay, so there is now a continuous symmetry, so you can rotate all the spins, which is O(n) symmetry. So far so easy. So we have different symmetry, so you may expect some different properties. So let's see what happens. So now of course you can go through the painful procedure of taking, you know, the Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, taking the continuum limit. You'll spend three more lectures on that. And then you'll find the Landau-Ginzburg functional, but of course you can write it down immediately just by the symmetry. Okay, so we have the corresponding Landau-Ginzburg functional, so now you have, well, basically for each of these, you have one phi, so you will have n phis now. Okay, so your parameter is now n-dimensional parameter. It's a vector phi, and it's just ddx, and then 1/2 nabla phi dot nabla phi, and then you will have something which is quadratic in phi as we had before. So this is what we have, phi square, but now it's vector phi square. And finally, you have u, and I don't know why there's no four factorial, it's standard is to use 4. So now you have phi, you know, phi square. And so this is your Landau-Ginzburg functional. And so that's something which describes your system. So now again, you could think, well, I can start doing my RG, and that's actually what you have done in your homework, if you have done your homework already. So I hope you recognize this thing here. Actually, your homework is slightly more complicated than this, but yeah, you can do so. Can do d, well, 4 minus d expansion. And this is what you have done in your homework. So I don't have to say much. The only thing which you find now is that your fixed points or whatever, and the critical exponents and everything associated with that will now depend on how many fields you have. So you know, critical exponents now, depend on n, which is how many of these fields, how many of these things we have. And you have probably done that if you have done your homework. And okay. So now this is all fine, and it will work nicely for d equal to 3. But if you go to lower dimensions, actually you'll start, you will find that this thing doesn't work anymore in some sense. And so, a new feature in two dimensions actually appears because you have now the presence of continuous symmetry. And so, near d equal to 2, actually physics is different. Physics is different. And you know this expansion is not good. And so what people do instead is they do an expansion around two dimensions. So we shall see what that means. But yeah. So before you are doing expansion around mean field theory, which is which gives the right result in 4D. So now we'll be doing an expansion around 2D. So that is d equal to 2 is some other interesting dimension which you can have in your system. Okay, so let me leave it here. So now what you can do is that you can write a different form for this Landau-Ginzburg functional. So what's the question? No. Alternative form.
You have nabla phi times nabla phi, which, how do you do the scalar product?
So so the scalar product is in between the vectors phi. So what this means is nabla, if I did write it, I would write phi a, where a goes from 1 to n, and then I will have an index here, let's say I, and so
both.
So there's two contractions there. Yeah, thanks for that question. So yeah, that's what it means. You have to have a scalar in the end, so you have to contract all the indices which can appear there. So of course this I goes from 1 to d, and this a goes from 1 to n. Okay, so the alternative form would be obtained is that, well, you say my vector phi of x can be written as its magnitude, which I call rho of x, and the corresponding unit vector n of x. Okay, so let's use this ansatz, and so we can rewrite the corresponding functional. And of course, okay, so if I do it, so I have nabla on phi a, so nabla I phi a. Well, if I use this phi a, it's given by nabla on rho n a. And then I have consequently two terms, right? So I have nabla on rho, and then na, and plus rho nabla on na. So if I want to write the kinetic term of my Landau-Ginzburg functional, then I have to square these things. So I'll have nabla phi a, nabla phi a. Well, square. Okay. So it's obvious that I will have terms like, this term squared. So it's rho square nabla and a square. Well, what I mean, nabla and a. Then I'll have that term squared. So which is na nabla rho square. And then I'll have a cross term. So then I'll have two times plus two times rho nabla rho, and then na nabla na. Okay, so that's just squaring these things. Of course, this thing, na and a, is just one, because it's just the magnitude of that unit vector. And then this thing here, it's of course a derivative, well, one half, well, whatever, of na. So this thing gives me actually zero because na is normalized. So here I'm saying na is one. It's just a vector which points in the direction of phi, and rho is the magnitude. Okay, so now this thing here is just this term and plus that term here. So now your S can be written as a S of rho nn, and it's ddx, ddx, and then one half Nabla rho square, which is this term here, and then plus one half rho square Nabla Na, Nabla Na. So that's the kinetic term. And then of course phi dot phi just gives me rho square, because n dot n is just one. So plus rho square plus r over 2 rho square and plus u over 4 rho 4. Okay, everybody happy so far? So that's a different form for this Landau-Ginzburg function for the vector model. Okay, so now let's analyze this. And so we will start doing, we'll not do what you have done in your homework, but instead we'll do first the mean field theory approximation, and then we'll do some perturbations around the mean field. Okay, and so let's see what we are going to get. So if we do the mean field theory approximation, so first mean field theory approximation, then you know that if you are given the Landau-Ginzburg functional to get basically Landau's theory out of it, which is the mean field theory approximation, which has forget about the spatial fluctuations of your field. Okay, so this thing is gone, and that thing is gone, and this is just your free energy. Was there a question? So your free energy is now just whatever your Landau-Ginzburg functional is, but without the fluctuations. Plus u over 4 rho to the 4. And so you know that you want to globally minimize this free energy to get something, to get what happens. So if we want to minimize, so we just do f prime equals to 0, while it's just r times rho plus u times rho cube, or rho r plus u rho square is not b equal to 0. So you get one solution, which is rho equal to 0, or another solution. So now you know that r is proportional to small t. So r can, you know, change signs, but u has to be positive, so that this is well defined. Okay, so if this guy is positive, well, this is positive, so this thing really must be negative. So if you are below critical temperature, so if r is smaller than 0, you have that solution. And so rho equals to rho 0 equals to square root of minus r over u. But if that is positive, well, I cannot never satisfy this thing, so I will have to have rho equal to 0. So r is positive, rho is equal to 0. Okay, so now if you look at this thing, so we have basically solved the problem. So now we know that in the ordered phase, well, this is the value, this is the magnitude of our order parameter, rho, 0. But if you see, so here, Na completely dropped out, right? So Na is arbitrary here. So what it means is that you only fixed the magnitude of your fields, well, but you can, you know, turn around, and so this Na is whatever you can think of. So now you have, you know, very, very important difference between what happened in the Ising model and what happens here because of this continuous symmetry. And so in the Ising model, and recall your tutorial, your free energy look like, so this was my field. And so in the ordered phase, it just looked like this. It had this discrete symmetry. So this is for r smaller than 0. And we had two minima, And so you would break the symmetry, you know, so they would be equal minima. And so this would precisely, well, they are equal, supposedly. So this is Z2 symmetry. And of course, the system would choose one minimum over the other. So well, now they look more equal. Still not really. Okay. So the system would spontaneously choose, you know, one of the minima. And then if he wanted to jump to the other one, it would actually have to go through that barrier. And so that, you know, happens if you wait long times and you have finite systems, but if you have infinite systems, never happens, basically. Okay, so now this is a discrete symmetry. So now in the case of the vector model, your free energy is actually, well, it depends on these many fields. Okay, so I have, let's say, in the case of two fields, I have phi 1 and then phi 2. And of course, you tell them that the magnitude in this space is fixed, so you have something like this. And then you have this Mexican hat thing. And then I don't know how to draw it here. This is very wrong, isn't it? Whatever. So we have phi 2 and phi 1, and I'll just... Okay, so I have this circle here. And then I go, I don't know how to draw it. Yeah, well, whatever. Okay. But you understand what I'm trying to say. Okay.
But you have to stress that there is a maximum in the middle of it.
Yeah. Well, it's obvious from the pictures. So now, you know, so the minima are not this, you know, so you can basically go from one minimum, this is a minimum here, another minimum here, they are all, you know, the same. And you can move from one to another by a continuous symmetry. Okay, so minima, so you now have a continuous symmetry connecting the minima. And so there's no really a barrier if I want to go from one to another. Then, you know, I can easily do that. And so fluctuations of order parameter are now much simpler. Of order parameter, much simpler now. So that's the crucial difference, basically. So in one case, I have to overcome the barrier to jump from one to another so it doesn't happen. But if I want to go from this guy to that guy, I'm still in the minimum. And so I don't have to climb any potential up, if you want. And so I can do it freely. Of course, that's not true if I wanted to go this way. Right? So if I wanted to go that way, that would be really stupid because I would have to, again, you know, do something strange. But if I stay in the minimum, I go, you know, the perpendicular way, then it's much simpler. Okay, and yeah. So now this is basically the crucial difference of the two models. And so let us look at what this means mathematically. So the mean field theory approximation is that, you know, the value of that minimum is rho zero, yeah?
Basically, we're describing like a spin system, right? So, like a metal, like.
Okay.
Right?
We are describing it, yeah.
Since there's still this continuous symmetry, even though it's spontaneously broken, does this mean that there's always going to be magnetization, but that the magnetization is going to turn around in the direction that external magnetic fields?
I'm just saying it's much easier, you know, to turn these spins around than it was there. At this point, I'm just saying that. But yeah, basically, yeah. So because you use that term, so this is so here we spontaneously broken the Z2 symmetry, choosing one minimum here, and choosing one particular direction, let's say this guy, going that way, we are spontaneously breaking this continuous symmetry, or which is now rotational symmetry. Okay, so that's our mean field. So now let's go beyond mean field. So let's consider. Fluctuations. Around mean field. And so now you write your phi x. I'll return back to this guy here, but I'll use the value of rho zero of the mean field in these things here. Okay, so I'll write phi x as rho zero times n, which is basically your mean field thing. So if you fix some n, this is precisely what mean field theory gives you. But you can choose any n. But yeah, this is the mean field theory, and then you have the fluctuation, which I write as delta phi is the fluctuation.
David?
Yeah.
You can okay.
I know. I'll hold it. I had already a disaster in this room with the hockey stick, so it's better not. Okay. So we have that. This is the mean field, and this is my fluctuation. And I split that fluctuation, delta phi vector, I split it into two parts, into the part which goes, along these directions, along those. I'll call those perpendicular directions. And then if I want to fluctuate in this way, then I'll call, it'll be in the direction of n. Okay, so there are two directions you can go. And so the first one in the direction of n, I call delta phi 1. Yeah?
Why is there a rho 0 there?
Because I'm choosing this to be really the mean field theory thing.
In the second term.
Here.
Should phi be something plus delta phi instead of something plus something?
That's right. So I just take that this delta phi has just the direction and not magnitude.
So that's delta n then, or
cool. So it's yeah. Yeah. Yeah, if you want. Yeah.
Is this delta phi normalized?
It is what I will write down. Delta phi perpendicular. So maybe you're right, it should be delta n. So that would be better notation, thanks. Anyway, I chose that notation here. Okay, so that's my fluctuation. And so this is fluctuations, which have to climb or up the potential. And these are the fluctuations which are, around that minimum, basically. Okay, so now, of course, what you require is that this thing is really perpendicular. So if you take a scalar product of n and delta phi perpendicular, you get equal to 0. So this is what I mean here. Okay, so now you can calculate. So you will have to write what this phi dot phi is and what the other term is. So
who designed this board?
I don't know. Well, it requires detailed balance condition. I don't know. Okay. Okay. So.
What are the lower boards doing?
So what is this? Is rho zero square, and then you will have n plus delta phi, and then scalar product n plus delta phi. Okay, so now if I take, this is rho zero square, if I take n with n, I just get 1. If I get delta phi with delta phi, I get delta phi 1 square plus delta phi perpendicular square. If I take now the cross terms, I will have n times delta phi. But if you do n times delta phi, well, if n times this thing is 0, n times m is 1, so it just gives you delta phi 1. Okay? So plus 2 delta phi 1. Everybody happy so far? Okay, so that's what phi dot phi is, but I also have phi dot phi square. Okay, so phi dot phi square, of course it's square of this. So let me do it just to quadratic perturbations. So it will be rho 0 to the power 4, and of course there will be 1. So now I'll have, so I have to square this thing here. So I'll have 4 delta phi 1, delta phi 1.
Square.
Well, also square.
Okay, okay, okay.
But yeah, if I have these two delta phi 1 and then another delta phi 1, I'll have that thing. And then you're right, so I'll have delta phi 1 square from one bracket, delta phi 1 square for another bracket, that's two of them. But then I can also square these guys. So it's 2 plus 4, so 6. 6 delta phi 1 square. And then I'll have 2 of those guys plus 2 delta phi perpendicular square.
Yeah, I still don't really get why you're pulling a rho 0 out there, because like now delta phi doesn't have the same dimension as phi anymore.
No, it doesn't, yeah. Yeah, it's I agree, it's a stupid notation, sorry for that. Yeah, it should be delta n, if you want. Yeah.
Okay. No, I think it's okay, because you like plot the rho 0, which is a constant, and then you redefine your field such that it's a dimensionless.
Yeah, but you don't really redefine your field, because the phi is both...
Just survive. I'm not going to change my notation now, so just survive the notation. Okay, so if you look at the functional s of phi now, okay, so what is it equal to? So it's ddx, and now I'm comparing this thing here. So, of course, this thing here will just split into two terms, into nabla phi 1 square and nabla phi perpendicular square. Okay, so this is simple. So this is just rho this thing here is uniform. So it doesn't contribute. So it will only appear in this fluctuations thing. So it's rho 0 square over 2, and then it's nabla, and then delta phi 1 square, and then plus rho 0 square over 2, nabla delta phi perpendicular a, nabla delta phi perpendicular a. And then plus, well, okay. And then plus r over 2. And then you have phi dot phi, which is this thing here, so it's rho 0 square, and then 1 plus delta phi 1 square plus whatever is written here, delta phi square plus 2 delta phi 1, and then plus u over 4 plus u over 4, and then rho to the 4, and whatever is written here. 1 plus 4 delta phi 1 plus 6 delta phi 1 square plus 2 delta phi square.
Just a question. By the way, is this u over
4
or u over 4 factorial?
I define it u over 4.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where did the cross term from the first term go?
Yeah,
where did
that go?
Well, they are perpendicular, so they are never. You can never have terms like delta phi 1 dot delta phi perpendicular. I mean here, right? So if I had delta phi 1, It means I will have n times delta phi 1, but because n times delta phi perpendicular is equal to 0, we cannot have those steps.
Could you show again picture how you define those directions?
Yeah, yeah. So this thing, if you go this way, it's delta phi 1. And if you go that way, it's delta phi perpendicular. So this is in the direction of n. So direction of n is that way.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so delta phi 1, you know, it's the one which you have to climb up the potential. Whereas delta phi perpendicular is the one which you are basically moving along the minimum, and you don't do any work.
And n is just radial.
And n is just radial thing. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. So this is what it is. And so now what you might want to do is that you may want to collect the terms which are, let's say, linear in delta phi 1. So if I try that, so I'll have delta phi 1. And then from here, I will have r over 2 rho 0 square times 2. That's this term here. And from here, that's this term here. And then that term is plus u over 4 rho 0 4 times 4. Okay, and if you did it correctly, and you use the fact that rho 0 is given by square root of minus r over u. So if you use that, you should get that this term drops out, and it gives you exactly 0. Well, that's sort of.
If you use what, sorry?
If you use the mean field theory thing, so that rho 0 square is minus r over u.
Yep.
If I use this, plug it here, it hopefully works. So this guy gives me minus r over u, so u cancels, it's minus r, and that cancels that plus r, so it works. Okay, so now this was one result, so one simplification. So now let's look at this delta phi perpendicular square. So delta phi perpendicular square. Okay, so it's this term here. So you have r over 2 rho 0 square. And similarly, if you look at this term here, then you have u over 2 plus u over 2 rho 0 to the 4. And again, it's the same equation as before. It's just equal to 0. And this is actually the most interesting and important result. So this is really something which is the whole point of doing these things. Finally, yeah, you can do for delta phi 1. And if you do delta phi 1, you get that the coefficient which stands by delta phi 1 square is just rho 0 square, absolute value of r, and delta phi 1. That's it. So, okay, so if you do similar calculation for that. So that's not interesting, but this is really important thing, that whatever stands by delta phi perpendicular square actually goes to 0. Very good. So now what that means means that your action is now given by ddx. Now you can take rho 0 square out, and then you'll have nabla delta phi 1 square, and then plus nabla delta phi perpendicular a nabla delta phi perpendicular a. And then there's only one mass term which stands by delta phi 1. Okay, so this is what your action now becomes if you expand around your mean field. Okay, so now this is basically what that picture, what this picture describes. This is the octopus Mexican head. Yes. So now you notice that there is no mass term. No mass term for delta phi perpendicular. So this is my kinetic term for phi 1. This is the corresponding mass term. So it would have m square delta phi 1 square if it's a field theory. So now this r plays the role of the mass. But here for phi perpendicular, we don't have any mass term. We just have the kinetic term. Okay, yes?
So just to be clear, we're always assuming r less than 0 right now?
We always assuming
r less than 0.
So this was for r less than 0. I use that value of that, but if you have rho equal to 0, well, probably everything goes to 0. Yeah.
And we're dropping all terms that are greater than 0.
That they are?
We're not keeping any of the, like, huge.
No, if r is
yeah, this
zero,
is only
we cannot define the fluctuations in that way, because we don't have an n.
Sorry? So we are keeping only to the quadratic order? Yeah, you could do higher order perturbations, but this is only to the quadratic order. Okay. So these things actually behave as massless modes. Massless modes. And they are called Goldstone bosons. So, whenever the Goldstone bosons are discussed in your quantum field theory 2 course, just remember. So, yeah.
Actually, these are the number Goldstone.
Huh?
Number Goldstone bosons.
If you want, yeah. If you like Nambu, yeah. I like Nambu. So anyway, these things, they behave as massless modes, and they are called Goldstone bosons. So the origin is because, so they always arise, more generally they arise, if when a continuous symmetry is spontaneously broken. So basically, we could, you know, have the minimum everywhere, but we chose one n, you know, and then we did the expansion around that n, you know, doing the fluctuation around that n, around the mean field theory thing, and so we broke the symmetry, and so we see that now these phi perpendicular actually describe, you know, modes, massless bosons, and it's due to the symmetry break here. Okay, so by the way, you can write this in the Fourier picture as well. And so, of course, all the derivatives will now become case multiplication by square. So now if I write it, well, whatever. I just write what I have here. So now instead of nabla, I will have k. So we'll have k square and then delta phi 1 of k square. And then the same thing for the other one, plus 2r delta phi 1 k of square, and then plus k square delta phi a k square. Okay, so now if you write it in this picture, so it's exactly the same thing what I'll be saying now, but you see that if I send k goes to zero, so I have zero momentum. Well, for delta phi 1, this term is gone, but this term, so why? So it still costs energy to actually produce these perturbations in the, you know, going up and down the thing. But if I send k equal to zero for these modes, then nothing survives. So as k goes to zero, so Goldstone bosons, number goals on modes do not cost any energy. And that means that, you know, I can have many, many modes going, you know, around that circle in the Mexican hat, and then they don't cost anything as long as k is, you know, sufficiently small, right? So I can have all these soft things going around it. You know, there's so many fluctuations around it, but they don't cost any energy. Okay.
Doesn't that always occur when you have something massless?
Exactly. That's why you have infinite divergences in your QED or whatever. Yeah. Exactly.
It's like a very, very special thing.
Yeah. It's a special thing that is massless thing. Yes. So of course, more generically, you know, the Goldstone bosons, you know, appear quite naturally. Basically, whenever you have massless particles, these are Goldstone modes, and some symmetry has to be broken. So another example of a Goldstone mode is, for example, if you have a, you know, if you are forming a crystal. Let's say I'm crystallizing something which was, you know, a liquid before, and now I'm crystallizing something. Then what happens is that you break the translational symmetry. So suddenly you create a crystal, and then you have your crystal lattice, and so you have your atoms in that crystal lattice, and so you break the symmetry. So forming a crystal breaks translational symmetry. And the corresponding Goldstone bosons are called acoustic modes. So acoustic phonons. And so you will study these in your condensed matter course. So it's basically vibrations of the lattice. And so how do I know that they are really that thing? So if you write down what the energy looks like, it's proportional to k. So it's just h bar speed of sound times k. So of course, if I send k goes to zero, then the energy goes to zero, and they don't cost anything. So I can have that many soft acoustic vibrations of the lattice, and yeah, that's fine. So Goldstone bosons. Another example in your field theory is, of course, photons. If you break the electroweak symmetry, then you get photons. And the photons, of course, have the same thing for the energy. This speed of sound in your is now speed of light in space time, but otherwise it's exactly
photons
the
same. Photons are not Goldstone. Photons are not Goldstone.
Of course they are. Why not?
What symmetry is broken?
No, the Goldstone bosons are those degrees of freedom that are eaten by the Z and Z bosons.
Okay.
The photon is the surviving degree of freedom from the breaking.
Yeah, but
it's still massive. Yes, but that does not make it.
But it comes from the broken of the symmetry.
It's the surviving
symmetry.
Yes, but it's the surviving symmetry, not.
Okay, ask the QFT guy. I'm not here to to react on this.
So what symmetry is being broken to create photons?
I think electroweak symmetry is broken. Okay. So we now have, you know, so they are quite generic things, these Goldstone bosons. And basically, whenever I have something massless, some symmetry has to be broken. And so, yeah, you can create lots of these soft things. Okay. So now, the last thing I would like to discuss about this model is the correlation function. Returning back to statistical physics, correlation function. And so you can discuss the correlation function for delta phi 1 and for delta phi perpendicular. Of course, for delta phi 1, it will be just the standard thing you know. So we are still doing this, you know, the expansion, basically fluctuation around the mean field theory value. So we still know that the average value of the field is n times rho 0. And so that the fluctuations basically have to be equal to 0 in average. And so your correlation function, gx minus x prime, of these fluctuations okay, you can calculate it in the momentum space, and for that you need to know a propagator for a scalar field. So 1 over v square, sum over k, and then I'll do it in momentum space, delta phi 1 k delta phi 1 minus k minus k, and then e to I k x minus x prime. Okay, and this is nothing else than the scalar field propagator, which you can see, you know, what it is from this expression here. So if I look at what how my action looks like in the momentum space, then the propagator, which stands, is just 1 over what you see in that action for the corresponding thing. So you see, I have delta phi 1 k square, and I have k square plus 2 r, and then what stands in front of it is rho square over 2. Okay, so now the propagator is just 1 over that. Okay, and then, so the propagator is just v over rho square 1 over k square plus 2r. Okay, of course, this is just the mass. And so what do you expect? So your these modes are massive. And so, of course, the mass affects, you know, how far the interaction goes. And so whenever you have something massive, the interaction exponentially decays, like 1 over, well, 1 over m. So this thing can be written, it's no surprise, x minus x prime, and now d minus 2, no anomalous dimension here, and then minus x prime over xi, where this xi is determined by your mass. So this correlation length psi is just 1 over square root of 2r.
Why don't we have an anomalous dimension?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, because here we are just doing just the first order.
Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Isn't this just exactly the same model as Ising again?
Yeah. Yeah, for this,
and
yeah, exactly.
We calculated to second order that there's no anomalous moments.
Yeah, you could do that.
Neither
yes.
Is there here.
Yeah, yeah. That's sounds good. So this delta phi 1 direction is precisely what we had for Ising, basically. Yes. So now you see, you know, in this case, I have again the correlation length diverges like 1 over square root of t. So the critical exponent just will be 1 half, you know, as predicted by mean field theory. So if you actually do this, you know, correlation function for these delta phi 1 things, then yeah, your mean field theory was fine. And these modes really, you know, will fluctuate around that point like usual. Okay, so now the other modes will be very different. So the other modes don't have mass. So the propagator, so now if you look at the correlation function, it's just 1 over the, well, 1 over the mass. So now we have 0 mass, which means that the correlation length will be infinite. Okay, as it must be, because you know that the interactions due massless particles are actually infinite. That's the Coulomb law 1 over r square. So for the other one, so if you want to calculate, so if I want to calculate delta phi perpendicular, so g perpendicular, which is delta phi a perpendicular x delta phi a perpendicular x prime. That's your correlation function. So now again, this is equal to 1 over v square sum over k, and then the same thing here, delta phi a perpendicular k delta phi a perpendicular minus k, and then e to I kx. Okay, so this is the same thing here, but now the propagator for this thing is massless. So first of all, you have this delta phi a, it's actually n minus 1 modes. So this thing is v over rho square n minus 1. It's coming from the summation over a, and then just k square. Okay, so what you conclude from here, of course, that there's no mass term here now, at least that the xi perpendicular is equal to infinity. So the correlation length, which if you define like 1 over m, it's infinite. So it's an infinite, you know, it's a very long interaction. It's like black photons, a very, very long interaction. Okay. So very good. So that's the expression for G perpendicular. Let me just, and this is for G perpendicular x minus x prime. So we are heading towards a famous theorem, which we don't prove, but we at least motivate it. So for that, it's actually advantageous to set x prime equal to x. So now setting x prime equal to x, we have that the g perpendicular in 0 now. Well, okay, so if x prime is equal to x, then this exponential is just 1. And I just have 1 over v rho square. And then I still have this n minus 1, sometimes n minus 1, and then sum over k, 1 over k square. Okay, which you can approximate by an integral. So if I take this 1 over v here, I can turn this to an integral over k. So this is n minus 1 over rho 0 square integral d dk 2 pi d, and then 1 over k square. Everybody happy so far? So now I change to spherical coordinates. So I have n minus 1 rho 0 square. No. K to d minus 1 as d dk over 2 pi to power d, and then 1 over k square. And so it's something as d n minus 1 2 pi d rho 0 square, and then an integral over k d minus 3 dk. Okay, so this is what g perpendicular describes is really basically the fluctuations, how big the fluctuations are due to these Goldstone modes, right? Due to these massless things. So really this is, you know, delta phi square, delta phi perpendicular square, at one point, and so how big the fluctuations are. Okay, so now what you can see here, so of course we still have this upper cutoff on dk, so that's my lambda cutoff, and that's given by 1 over a, the lattice spacing. So we have that. But in principle, because there is no cutoff for k, you know, to be bigger than something, it can go from 0 to lambda. Okay? So now you fix this proportion of 1 over a, and it's given by you know, your lattice or whatever. But this is some finite number, finite cutoff here. So now the question is, when this integral converges, and when does it diverge? If it diverges, then the fluctuations around my mean field theory will be huge, will be divergent. If they are divergent, the mean field theory breaks down, and everything I said before breaks down. So in particular, I said that there was like an ordered thing. I chose spontaneously chosen one direction, and that was my n. And I spontaneously chosen, you know, these fields there, the order parameters to be equal to something. So now if the integral diverges, that assumption was wrong, and I couldn't do that. Okay, so when does this integral diverge? Because of small momenta.
Well, when we have d equal to, it will be just in the limit of the divergence. So I would need a bigger dimension.
Very good. So if we have d bigger than 2, the integral converges. And if the integral converges, that means that, you know, the mean field theory assumption, if you want, assumption that we really have some ordered phase, and then we have some small fluctuations around it, then was okay. Was okay. So that means that you know, the Goldstone modes actually give a finite contribution to your fluctuations around this mean field. And so order phase can exist and is more or less described by mean field theory. Well, of course, up to the fact that the true critical temperature will be smaller than the one predicted by mean field theory, because you have now fluctuations which you neglected in mean field theory and so on. But yeah, if the integral converges, which happens for d bigger than 2, you can have the ordered phase. But as you said, if d is equal to 2 or in fact smaller than 2, then, you know, I have a divergence close to 0. Right? If it's equal to 2, I'll have something like a logarithm, which of course diverges, you know. So if this thing here, then the integral diverges. And so it means that, you know, the assumption that we had ordered phase in the mean field theory was wrong. And so the fluctuations are so big. So these fluctuations are basically infinite. And so if you have infinite fluctuations, you cannot have order. So diverges, ordered phase cannot exist. Okay, so this is what we concluded, just based, you know, on the fact that there was no cutoff for you know, how small k can be. You know, you would create these Goldstone modes for arbitrary small k, and so now in two dimensions this is a disaster, because, you know, their contribution to fluctuations is actually infinite. Okay, so no matter if I started this ordered phase, the fluctuation will be so huge that they will destroy the ordered phase.
But for two dimensions, this is also not a continuum. No, that was what
you did. If you had d equal to 2, you would have 1 over k, you would have logarithm of okay. 0, which of course I think is infinite. Yeah, so for d equal to 2 as well. So now this is a motivation, it's not a proof, well, sort of it's a proof, but not really. It's a motivation of a famous theorem, which is known in particle physics as Coleman theorem, and in condensed matter physics as Mermin-Wagner theorem. Okay, so Coleman, Mermin, Wagner theorem, which can basically be formulated as for systems with continuous symmetry. Symmetry. There is no long range order. Order for the smaller or equal than 2. Sort of motivated this. So basically, yeah, if I have continuous symmetry, I break that symmetry, I will have the corresponding bosons, Goldstone bosons, and their fluctuations will break the symmetry, will break the ordering. Basically, that's the argument here. So famous theorem.
So actually,
there is one thing.
Yeah.
There is another thing that is important here. It is important that there is no long range order at finite temperature.
Yeah. Long finite for the there's no long range order. That is correct. Finite temperature. I have it in my notes, I just couldn't read it. thanks, Dennis. Did you have a question?
Yeah. So, well, we got this by starting from an assumption of mean field theory, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe. So, how do we get a general result? We started by an assumption that.
Oh, I haven't proved it, right? So that would take.
Oh, it's not just.
Yeah, this is not a proof. I'm just, you know, this was like a motivation. We started with the mean field theory, which sort of assumed there is some ordered phase. And then I showed, you know, making a fluctuations around this ordered phase, you would break that order. But it seems possible, right? But this is not a proof of that. Yeah. It's fair enough. Other questions? So in fact, what happens is that you have actually, you know, two important dimensions. Unfortunately, none of them is equal to 3, which is our world. So you have this upper critical dimension, dimension, which is d equal to 4, which we already know, and it's, you know, when the mean field theory gives correct critical exponents, so the predictions of the mean field theory are okay in d equal to 4 and higher, and then there is this lower critical dimension. Which is d equal to 2, and you know that limit as d equals to 2 plus of t critical is equal to 0. So you know that you cannot have any ordered phase. You cannot have a phase transition at any temperature which is bigger than 0. In two and less dimensions. Yes?
Well, are you making the assumption that the critical temperature is a continuous function of dimension?
I'm not. So I'm saying, if you are, well, because we will be doing expansion around two dimensions.
Yeah, but the only thing, like the reason you say that is because of the theorem.
Yes.
The theorem doesn't say anything about d bigger than 2. It says things about d smaller than or equal to 2. So you're assuming something's continuous. Right?
Okay, yeah. I'll be doing continuous perturbation around 0, the critical temperature, around two dimensions. Yes. Of course, you know, that's an additional assumption. It's not proof by the theorem. That's something which
you're
people do.
You're not assuming it's analytical, because then perturbation is very easy, right? Because dc of d, the first derivative, like the in linear and epsilon, it has to be 0 because it's you also can go for a negative epsilon, then you know it's going to be 0. And the second
That's
order
right.
in epsilon is going to be 0.
Okay.
So you're also not just doing perturbation theory. You're kind of doing perturbation theory, but only to one side.
Well, you can do it on the other side as well.
That's the point. They're different.
Okay, fair enough. So what I mean by this is really that in decoupled to two dimensions, you can have critical temperature, but it must be equal to zero. In higher dimensions, it can be a finite critical temperature, but below two dimensions, cannot. Okay, so if you don't like this, some people don't. Okay, so that, you know, suggests that here you can do this expansion in epsilon, which is 4 minus d expansion. And you have seen that for the Ising model. And here people do an expansion where they say, well, 2 plus epsilon expansion. And, you know, do this thing here, and it also works sort of okay. Okay, so that's basically two. So just remember, there's two critical things. One is the lower critical dimension, one is the upper one. But they of course describe different things. So the upper one is really mean field theory, you know, gets the right things, and d equal to two tells you I cannot have order, long range order below two dimensions. Okay. By the way, for the Ising model, what happens for the Ising model? What is the critical lower critical dimension for the Ising model? When do we have phase transition for the Ising model?
In this.
In two dimensions we have. What happens in one dimension?
The critical temperature is zero.
Yeah. So exactly. So for the Ising model, it would be, you know, dimension equal to one. So that'll be the lower critical dimension. But of course, Ising model doesn't have continuous symmetry. So it's not this thing here. It doesn't apply to that. But if you have continuous symmetry, it's t equal to 2. So system which has continuous symmetry in one dimension cannot have.
So the critical of Ising is still b equals 4, right?
Sorry?
Upper critical of the Ising model is still d equals 4.
That's right. For this vector model, it will be still d equal to 4 as well. So, you know, basically, you know, the fact whether you have continuous symmetry or not really, and if you keep increasing the number of dimensions, then it doesn't really matter. So yeah, the upper critical dimension will be for both systems, it will be 4. but the lower critical one will be different, because lower you get, you know, the symmetry more matters in some sense. Yeah. All right. Let me stop here.